This is Marshall Masters for Yowza.com. That's YOWUSA.com. And today we're going to cut to the chase with Dr. Paul LaViolette. Not too long ago, folks, we had Paul LaViolette on to talk about his book, Earth Under Fire, Humanity's Survival of the Ice Age. And, well, y'all just locked that one, and y'all also happened to buy a whole lot of his books, which was really good, so we asked Paul to come back on to talk about another really interesting book he's written called Decoding the Message of the Pulsars, Intelligent Communication from the Galaxy. And a key point that Paul is making in this real groundbreaking book is that pulsars are proof, I want to emphasize that word, proof of intelligent design. And when used according to what he feels is their design, that pulsars can give us a lot more information than a convenient way to set the atomic clock. It can also tell us when we're traveling deep into space, beyond the reaches of our own solar system, where we're at. And also, of equal importance, is that they can warn us of galactic superwaves. And these could very well be one of the greatest threats to life on this planet. And this is of vital interest to those of us living today, because according to Paul, we're moving into the crosshairs. So, let's get into this interview and find out exactly why.
Get a job, pay your taxes, pay your dues. You can live any way that you want to, as long as you don't break any of their rules.
This is Marshall, and I'm on with Dr. Paul LaViolette, author of Decoding of the Message of the Pulsars. Paul, welcome back to Cut to the Chase.
Glad to be here.
Wow, we're really glad you're here. And the last interview we had you on, we got into some really interesting conversations on superwaves. And here we have in your book, Decoding the Message of the Pulsars, where some of these pulsars, as I understand it from your book, are like lighthouses, signal beacons, telling us about past superwave events. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
Well, what exactly are they warning us about, and are all pulsars part of this warning system?
Not all pulsars. A handful are orchestrating this message specifically for us, calling our attention to this last major superwave that passed us between 16,000 and 11,000 years ago. But the rest of the pulsars, I believe, are... they're sort of randomly scattered through various parts of the galaxy and are part of a sort of a galactic positioning system, like our own GPS system, but used for space travel navigation. Or they could be used. I mean, the question is, what could be their use? You can see that the nature of pulsar signals is artificial. They're not... it's not something that could be produced naturally, because up until now there have been no models that astronomers have put forth that explain them as natural sources, even though they claim them to be. But that's just big talk. There's nothing behind it to prove what they're saying.
Okay, so let me get this straight. What you're saying is that a pulsar is not necessarily a naturally occurring phenomena, but rather there is an intelligent design behind a pulsar?
Right, the creation of the signal. Now, the source, the stellar source, is natural. You can say it could be an X-ray star, a neutron star, that's putting out a wind of cosmic rays.
Right.
What's different is that some civilization has come along and learned how to use that wind of cosmic rays to create energy signals, radio signals.
Right.
So, whereas if we were to do it, we would put an accelerator up in space, which we could build here on Earth, a linear accelerator like we have at Stanford, and then take those electrons that come out, cosmic ray electrons come out of the accelerator, and we put them through a ripple magnetic field, and that would cause them to emit radio waves. It's what's called synchrotron radiation, which was radiation observed coming from a particle accelerator, and they called it synchrotron radiation because the accelerator was called a synchrotron. And that's it's not like radio signals from our radio transmitters, which are specific frequencies. Synchrotron radiation covers whole series of frequencies. It's all the way from low frequency radio on up through optical into X-ray and gamma ray in some cases. But in the case of the radio pulsars, most of that is radio signals, just broadband radio signals coming from them.
So then, in essence, take a look at like SETI, for example, and they're looking for signs of extraterrestrial life by monitoring simple radio waves. And what they're finding is that this is all natural occurrence. They haven't found an intelligent radio signal yet. But they're looking because you can take this natural phenomena of radio waves and put it into a coherent message through an intelligent design. And what you're saying then is that the pulsars are, they're going to exist in nature with or without some kind of intelligent intervention, but in this particular case, certain pulsars are being specifically created or modified, if you will, into something that is now a coherent message.
Well, if it's a pulsar, it's already been modified.
Okay.
If it's just a steady source, which we would call a neutron star, that would be more of a natural object. But what's unnatural is for these things to flash, in some cases, hundreds of times a second, to be so precise that you can set atomic clocks to them. These are things that you don't find normally in nature.
Right.
And you start analyzing these pulses, and you see they have these patterns where what they call subpulses, which is like each pulse I call a subpulse, and when they add them up, they find they produce this pattern pulse, sort of integrated pulse, which is the summation of all the previous pulses. If you compare that to like your TV screen where you're projecting an image, and it's made from individual scans across the TV tube, when you study that picture that comes out and you see how accurate that is. It's something that doesn't change over time. Each pulsar has its own unique wave pattern to its pulse. You begin to realize that this is not something that nature could do.
And so in other words, each of these pulsars is like fingerprints. They all have their own unique pattern?
Right. Each one you can identify it just like it has a fingerprint. By its radio characteristics.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like lighthouses. Every lighthouse, for those who are, make their living in the sea, I understand that every lighthouse has a coded light message it sends out that uniquely identifies it to all mariners. They don't all use the same light sequence. And the same things here. If someone's got all of these cataloged, like there's a catalog of lighthouses of the world, all you have to do is, find out what the coded message is or the sequence, and there you are. You know exactly what you're looking at, right?
Yeah, except in this case, it's not a beam whirling around. That's the lighthouse, the standard lighthouse model that astronomers have come up with to try to explain it, which is not correct. The beam is fixed. It's directed towards us. All the pulsar signals that we're seeing, which is over 1,000 scattered throughout the galaxy, the beams are actually directed towards our solar system. And there would be other beams from those same stars, so pulsar stars, directed to other solar systems. But we just don't see those. We're only seeing the beams that are coming to us.
So these are line-of-sight messages.
Right. Yeah. They're aware that there's people here that are going to be watching. And if they're used for navigation, which is the other interpretation for them, at least for the majority of pulsars, it looks like you can conjecture that it's part of a navigation system. It would indicate that there's a section in our vicinity, which is sort of like a spaceport, you could imagine, going to other parts of the galaxy. And they would need those beacons to be able to know where the heck they are in the galaxy. So when they get to the next place, there'd be new beacons for that part. You know. The nice thing about pulsars is that you could monitor your speed even if you're going close to the speed of light. Because one thing that happens is you go close to the speed of light, time slows down. And with the pulsars, their signals, even though they're very precise in the timing, they're slowing down also at the same time. Mm-hmm. So if you already know the rate at which it's supposed to slow down, and you know what you're seeing it as it's slowing down, as you're going, let's say, close to the speed of light, you'll see that it's different from what you'd expect. From that, you can do calculations, run it through your computer, and come out exactly with how fast you're going, what to give corrections for the rate of time slowing down and everything. So they are really quite ideal for space travel. You know, if we were going to design a GPS system for space travel, they have all the characteristics we would need.
Wow, that is amazing.
The other thing is, because the radio signals are over all a broad band of frequencies, no matter how fast you're going, you're always going to see them. If it was a radio station at a certain frequency, let's say you tuned to that radio frequency, as you accelerated towards the speed of light, that's going to blue shift out of your tuning frequency, and
right.
It would disappear.
Uh-huh.
Whereas a pulsar would never do that.
So then this is really a phenomenal interstellar navigation aid.
To fathom this, it means that, first of all, that not only there's life out there, but it's on a galactic scale, that it's probably peaceful, because otherwise how could you have a civilization on a galactic level unless it was peaceful?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they're indicating to us about a catastrophic event that happened in the past indicates that they're trying to help us. So the idea that they're out to get us is just a lot of fear that's being put out by some groups.
Yeah, we're just basically echoing our own fears. We're whistling in the dark.
Or, you know, maybe there are civilizations that are hostile. But the thing is, there's hope that there are some that aren't hostile, and it seems they have the upper hand because they're the ones that have the network for traveling throughout the galaxy. They've set these beacons up. This is all, of course, conjecture. How are we to know for sure? But it's something that stimulates imagination when you make these discoveries.
You stop to think about imagination and how powerful that is. If we look at, this is coming up on the last season of Stargate SG-1. That has been a show that's run for 10 years. That's long legs. And where the ancients set up all of these teleportal channels with wormholes. And, you know, that is something that has really tapped into our minds. And it's resonating at a deeper level than entertainment, from what I think.
Yeah, the first part of that movie came out of my book, you know, out of Genesis of the Cosmos.
Really?
A part about the Stargate ring, where they had those hieroglyphic symbols around, and they were rotating the first one way, then the other.
Uh-huh.
It came out of my, I had a treatment for Hollywood that was circulating, where it talked about the Sphinx being like a Stargate portal, and it's used to decode the zodiac symbols, And when you do the decoding, if you see the zodiac symbols as a ring, like they usually laid out in a circle, you begin at a certain point with a certain sign, and then you go first to the right, and then to the left, and then back to the right, as if you're opening a safe. And that part, it seems, it made it into the movie. Fortunately, I would have liked they put my name there to reference where the idea came from.
Well, you know what they say in Hollywood, don't believe anybody until you see your name in the credits and the check clears the bank. You didn't get either. But, you know, you're in good company. But it's interesting that your treatment did, and it's nice that we can put it out on this show, that SG-1 was part of that, was a little bit of your brainchild. And I think that's really, really cool. In the next segment, what I want to do is really dive deep into what these pulsars are warning us about, which are the superwave events, and which you document very carefully in your other book, Earth Under Fire. And because Earth has been slammed very, very hard. It has caused extinction-level events, ice ages, you know, to begin, ice ages to end. It has really driven, if you will, the evolution of life on our planet. And I want to dive into that real heavy with you, okay? We'll get back to Paul in just a moment, but first I want to tell you a little bit about Yowza.com, and I also want to talk about an article I just put up on the site. Yowza's core mission is to provide public education for the difficult times ahead. We're a secular site, and our belief is that we're going to go through a tough time, but on the back end of it, there will be an enlightened age, so don't lose hope. All the information on the site is available for free to the public. For subscribers, we have special bonuses, ebooks, and also you can download MP3s of all the past Cut to the Chase shows, and this one as well. Regardless whether you subscribe or not, we hope that you care enough to become informed. But if you care enough to make a difference, please, your support makes this site possible, so subscribe today. We have plans that start at $6 a month, several of them that include a book. So check them out, won't you? We sure would appreciate your direct support. Now I'd like to talk briefly about an article that I posted on the website, and it's called Man-Made Global Warming is a Global Cooling Conspiracy. At Yowza, we have been following this issue since the very beginning. It's actually why I started the site. And what we found early on in our research was that the sun is the primary engine of global warming, and that is now becoming the new consensus amongst a growing number of global warming researchers. We also found that man-made pollution is exacerbating the global warming effect. In my article, I explain what's happening in terms of what we're going to face in the 2012 time frame. And you might find this a little shocking, but yes, we're loading the atmosphere with carbon, and yes, there is a reason, and I am glad that there is so much utter total confusion out there, because this is really what we need to do. Read the article, and then you'll understand why. Now let's get back to our interview. First segment, we were talking about the pulsars being an interstellar GPS system, if you will, telling us about past superwave events. But let's focus on superwave events as it relates to the evolution of life on this planet. And that is something Earth Under Fire, your other book, really discusses, and I want to cover that in this segment. So what has, when was the last time a superwave hit the Earth, and what were the effects? And then give us a few more. I know that you had like 5,200 years ago, 16,000 years ago, 37,000 years, 65,000 years ago. Mm. Talk to us about those periods.
Yeah, you can see that from the ice core record, Earth's polar ice core record, and you look at for a certain element called beryllium-10, which is radioactive, and it's produced by cosmic rays hitting our atmosphere. So that gives us kind of a chart of how the cosmic ray levels have varied in the past. And you see there were these peaks. The last major set of peaks was between 16,000 and 11,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that they tend to coincide with the beginnings and endings of glacial periods.
Mm-hmm.
So you realize that these things have climatic effects on the Earth. And originally, when I first came up with the idea that these things occur, I thought it was the cosmic rays themselves that somehow heated the Earth to cause these climatic changes. But then realized it wasn't the cosmic rays themselves, but the cosmic dust that they bring into the solar system that does the heating part.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really aggravates everything, is that dust.
Like a sandstorm.
Yeah. You see, we're in a dusty part of the galaxy right now, and mm-hmm. not only dust, but cometary debris. Like these comets that come in and go out, they call them long-period comets.
Right.
They find they come from a certain direction in space, which is the direction towards which our solar system is moving. And what that means is that it's not that they are necessarily coming to us, it's that we are going through this field of debris, sort of like as if going through an asteroid belt, you know, and eventually some of these things are going to come into our solar system. All this stuff that's hanging around out there is part of this supernova remnant shell that we're going through. And this is stuff that astronomers have become aware of just in the last 20, 30 years.
So then what, we're really like a eight ball in the break. We're right in the middle.
Yeah, we're in a bad part of the galaxy right now, so to speak. In fact, we've got a pretty dense dust cloud fairly close to us. But it's not just the stuff outside the solar system. It sort of charges up our own debris that sort of circulates in the immediate vicinity of the solar system, including out past Saturn. There's this whole field of debris they discovered with the Ulysses satellite. In fact, I was the first really to talk about the solar system being immersed in all this debris. That was back in 83.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, all this stuff has come out to show, yeah, that that's in fact true. In fact, that cosmic dust or interstellar dust is coming into our solar system currently from the direction of the galactic center.
Right.
And I was saying that there would be this residual wind of material coming in left over from the previous superwave. So that all fits.
Wow. Now, as I recall, you said that one major superwave event 37,000 years ago was probably responsible for the extinction of the Neanderthal.
Right. One of the major peaks of cosmic ray events occurs 37,000 years ago, approximately, mm-hmm. which is about when Neanderthal man became extinct.
So how would Cro-Magnon have survived a superwave where Neanderthal did not?
Well, they probably were living in caves to get if it was like due to if there was a solar conflagration associated with it. To get out away from the heat, then the two main dangers are the extreme heat and the radiation effects, ultraviolet radiation, because the ozone layer of the Earth could have become destroyed during these events.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were out during the day, you could have come back with severe skin cancer conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So people would have probably gone out at night during this period of this harmful radiation period. The other aspect is the floods, because this was during a period of glacial coverage, mm-hmm. ice sheets. And whenever you get warming of the climate with ice covering the planet, you're going to get ice melting, and it's going to form these lakes of water at a very high altitude on the ice sheet. And if you get a dam breaking on one of these lakes and creates a surge of water going across the ice sheet, that has a domino effect which would trigger the emptying of all the other lakes, and pretty soon you get this tidal wave, this huge tsunami of water coming down from the ice sheet, and would just sweep across the land. And you see evidence of this, like the mastodons and the mammoths. In Alaska and Siberia, they find the remains of these Pleistocene animals frozen in the tundra. And I devote a whole chapter in my book, On Earth Under Fire, to the flood deposits and evidence for the flood. And you converge on the conclusion that this was from a freshwater flood coming from the ice sheets, and that it was a catastrophic event. So you picture like these mastodons out grazing, because they found in some cases their bodies seemed very well preserved, and they even found buttercups in their stomachs in some cases. Mm-hmm. So you can picture that the climate was warm enough that you had grass growing out there in the fields, and suddenly one of these huge waves coming off of the ice sheet, thundering towards them. And they don't have time to get away from it, and eventually it just rips up everything in its path and deposits it. And mm-hmm. so they get sort of packed in ice, which the ice helps to preserve them, mm-hmm. Along with all the soil. And just like you'd expect, the heavy parts are at the bottom, and the lighter, like the pieces of wood and the tissue and stuff like that, those bits are towards the top. Mm-hmm. So you have this gradation of deposits, and that indicates what's called catastrophic deposition. That's what geologists call it. Mm-hmm. And so it all kinds of fits together. You even find pieces of ice packed in there, and it's freshwater ice. So it sort of refutes ideas that some have suggested that these animals were killed by a seismic event, like a flipping of the Earth's pole that might have sloshed the oceans over, because mm-hmm. you don't find salt water there. Mm-hmm. This occurred in conjunction with burning of the Earth by the sun. Mm-hmm. You find this in the myths. About 25% of my book is dealing with legends and myths, because I draw on this information as an important source of data. In other words, not just astronomical data or geological, but also mm-hmm. go for the myths. There's a lot of astronomical data discussed, for example, for the superwave itself. Now, superwave, this is essentially a blast of cosmic rays coming from the center of our galaxy, which, let's say, lasts anywhere from 100 years to several thousand years. Mm-hmm. So you can picture this like a bubble expanding out from the center of the galaxy, and the film of the bubble, the shell, is the danger zone. And this travels out at the speed of light, and then when finally it arrives here, we don't see it coming until it's already here, because it travels at the speed of light. It's just as fast as the light from the explosion would be traveling. And then it envelops the solar system, and then for several thousand years, let's say, we have these cosmic rays coming through us, through the solar system, bringing this cosmic dust into the solar system, vaporizing pieces of ice out there. Comets would become vaporized. They would produce a sort of a nebula, a cloud around the solar system. We would no longer see the stars. The moon could even become engulfed in dust, like in some myths. Mm-hmm. The sun, there's stories of how the sun is enshrouded in dust. Mm-hmm. Or in one case, about a rabbit putting a sack over the sun. And then the next part of the myth tells about how the sun, as a result, burns the Earth, because the dust being around the sun ends up aggravating the sun, because the light can't get out as it normally does. It gets reflected back onto the surface of the sun, and that ends up heating up the surface of the sun. This is a phenomenon we produced even with light bulbs. You put a a shield over the surface that reflects the heat back onto the filament. Filament's going to get hotter, so it's a pretty straightforward concept. But you also have the stuff falling onto the surface of the sun that heats up the surface. And the sun would have been totally different, let's put it this way, from what we see today.
Mm-hmm. What would it look like?
It would look like what they call T Tauri stars, which we see these stars in other parts of the galaxy where they're surrounded with dust, and they're flaring all the time. In other words, where we have these solar cycle peaks, where we have solar flares peaking at a certain time in the solar cycle, these flare stars, they would be having flares over their entire surface all the time. And you still have peaks, but you're talking about levels of solar activity that are 100 or 1,000 times higher than what we observe today. I mean, it's just inconceivable. You could have these coronal mass ejections coming out from the sun where one would come off and then another one immediately behind it and would fuse with it to make an even larger coronal mass ejection. And you would get ones that we just have not seen in recorded history. They would be strong enough to actually overpower the Earth's magnetic field and actually cause a flip of the Earth's magnetic pole.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, where there would be no magnetic field protection, so it could actually, this plasma, it would be like a coronal plasma, would just come and contact the surface of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that the worst event occurred around 12,700 years ago, because mm-hmm. you see a black horizon. It's called the Ucello horizon in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And the geologist Dr. Klosterman has noted that this is found all over Europe, and he's also correlated with a similar black layer in Mexico in southern U.S. And this is the horizon where there was the mass extinction of the Pleistocene mammals,
mm-hmm.
where after that date you didn't find any mammals surviving
mm-hmm.
of the large animals. Something like 95% of the large animals in North America became extinct at that horizon. And it wasn't due to people with bows and arrows, like some of the paleontologists suggest.
Right.
You find the soil is actually radioactive at that level.
So we didn't kill the woolly mammoths.
No.
All right. Something much, much greater did that.
And if that was the case, how come the Indians didn't extinguish the bisons, you know?
No, we came pretty close to doing that ourselves.
Yeah, we did with rifles, of course.
Yeah. Very, very effective. Those mm-hmm. are powerful rifles. I fired them, and wow. Those guys that were doing them all day long must have had pretty stout shoulders. And, mm-hmm. You know, all of this, when we're looking at this cycle where the Neanderthals, the woolly mammoths, we're talking about some major extinction-level events, and, you know, and as you said before, we're going through a pretty dirty part of the galaxy right now, where there's a more likelihood of more of the same. So now the question becomes one where we go back to the initial essence of your book, Decoding the Message of the Pulsars, and that there's an intelligence behind these. And the intelligence is going to be logical. I mean, there's a couple of good reasons for it, as we pointed out. One is that, you know, no different than signal fires and lighthouses and what have you. We're extending a warning message out there, but also it's a navigation aid like GPS satellites. So in the next segment when we come back, what I'd like to do is say, all right, if we were to take your theories to heart so that we could then travel faster than the speed of light, how could we use that plus your knowledge of superways to ensure the survival of humanity? You up for that?
Sure.
All righty.
Before we get back to Paul, I just want to have a special message out there for you subscribers. I've got a link down there to the interview we did with Rick Firestone on the cycle of cosmic catastrophes. After you listen to this interview, you really want to go download the Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes interview I did with Rick, because it's going to be extremely powerful. So, subscribers, go snag that MP3 file. Now, let's get back to Paul and decoding the message of the pulsars.
Oh, give us something to hold on to as a venture.
Paul, in this last segment, you know, what I really want to focus in on is the survival of humankind. I've always been in this for the species. And I do not believe that your theories are simply being read in Hollywood and becoming part of Stargate SG-1. But I think also they're being read in other centers of power. And an example of that is the Herculean effort that's going on right now to put solar observatories into space. I mean, since 1995, we've had one, which was SOHO, and we've been watching those images. But by 2008, we're going to have six, not one, but six solar observatories monitoring the sun in any way imaginable. And including SOHO, which had its mission extended to 2009. That's quite something for an old bird. So you're talking about how our sun is going to be impacted and affected by a superwave with the consequences for us. And our governments are out here looking at our sun to make sure they're going to know exactly what's doing in a way that's never before been possible and on a Herculean scale. So, getting back to the question I had from the last segment, in your book, you talk about how we could travel faster than the speed of light. If we were to use that capability with what you've told us about the pulsars and about the consequences we face from superwaves, how do we save humanity?
Well, you could picture traveling to another planet that's not in a congested part of the galaxy where the star would not have a lot of dust around it. So in that case, the cosmic rays from the superwave would be more benign. You would still have a gravity wave associated, which that part of it would still be a problem, which would cause earthquakes or planet quakes and wherever you were. But you wouldn't have the ice age type stuff or solar conflagrations occurring. We were in such a state here before this series of ice ages began. The ice epoch we're in has lasted for the last 3 million years or so. But for some reason, the ice ages were not present earlier than about 3 million years ago. And you could explain this because we were in a cleaner part of the galaxy during that period, so the superwaves weren't creating the ice ages at that time. So, you know, maybe you could imagine there are civilizations that are concerned about preserving life that would evacuate species from a planet if the planet was in danger of becoming extinct by its star. And in fact, there are some stars that at certain point it can become unstable and go turn into supernova explosion, like the Crab Nebula is one, and the Vela. These are two that are nearby us.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things, you know, we talked about in the last interview, by the way, on Rick Firestone, and he does cite you in his book. You are in his bibliography, and he does tell us that we're passing through a part of the galaxy right now where there's been an awful lot of supernova events. So we're going through this, these what he calls supernova bubbles. And
yes.
There's an awful lot of debris out there, and this causes all kinds of problems for us. So first off, how would someone of more advanced, whether it's ourselves or someone who wants to ride in like white knights and save us because they want to see life flourish, how would they see this superwave coming?
Well, you can send signals faster than the speed of light, I believe, if you have the right technology. For example, Eugene Plotkin's gravity beam projector, he's been able to send pulses up to 48 times the speed of light as a minimum. It's just his oscilloscope was not fast enough to see the true speed. It could have been hundreds of times the speed of light. And those pulses, they were able to transmit over 100 kilometers, several hundred kilometers, at least, and probably they went much further. So you could imagine beams like this are set up in the galaxy to communicate from civilizations that are closer in towards the center. So when the super wave reaches them, then they know it's time of arrival, and they signal the other civilizations further out when to expect the superwave to arrive there, using signals that travel much faster than light.
Okay. So, well, kind of, that's interesting. Star Trek had that. They had, like, subspace channel, and they could send messages to Earth faster than the speed of light. So that's really something that's been out there in the public.
And it's very simple how to build these devices. It's not any rocket science.
Mm-hmm.
You just have a capacitor discharge from a sphere. You discharge a capacitor onto a sphere, and that's going to create a pulse that travels faster than the speed of light. It's an electric pulse. The only trouble is it will drop in speed as it goes away because it has a spherical symmetry. Mm-hmm. So anytime you have that kind of symmetry as you go away, your intensity drops off and also your speed drops off.
Right.
Plotkin has developed something that keeps itself confined as a beam. So he's able to keep his high speed with that.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. It goes to perhaps the reason why SETI is not finding what it's looking for. Perhaps we're looking for something that's so incredibly primitive. When you stop to think about it, you're already talking about this capability to send these messages faster than the speed of light. And how long has radio been around? So if you're talking about it now, it could definitely be it goes from the theoretical to the reality of how we communicate not too far from now. And so SETI is out there looking for radio waves. I mean, it's a very small slice of the technological pie to catch these messages coming from somewhere else. If they were monitoring using this type of technology that you're talking about, it'd be interesting what they would be able to overhear.
Yeah, I think SETI is looking for the wrong type of signal sources.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop to think, looking for a discrete frequency is very difficult because your radio receiver has to be tuned to that particular frequency, or else you have to scan, like radio telescopes are designed to pick up many, many frequencies at once. And so you'd have to sift through all those frequencies like they're doing using people's computer time in order to find any message. Whereas, wouldn't it make it more sense if a civilization wanted to make it easy for you to see their signal? They would transmit over a whole broad band of frequencies.
Right.
Using this flashing technique, which is what they use.
Mm-hmm.
So really we've known about messages being sent to us since the discovery of pulsars, which was back 67 or so. So it's been, 40 years or so now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's not been acknowledged by the scientific community. SETI is really a program, I think, that wants to be looking, but it feels safe that they haven't found anything yet.
So basically they're just a big placebo.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be the first.
I mean, it's pathetic what goes on in today's society, to be honest.
Yeah.
The same with NASA. You know, it's all just a cover organization using rocket technology to put up satellites and spacecraft when we've got stuff that's much more advanced.
Yes.
They didn't never tell us about.
That's right. But these are just the mysteries of how these things work out. Everybody's, it's always look for the buck, cherchez le buck. You know, one of the things that was interesting was on the cover of your book, Decoding the Message of the Pulsars, you have a picture of a crop circle. How does that work in?
Well, I was giving that as an example of the kind of technology that could be used to create the pulsar signals. It's a way of transmitting forces at a distance. Mm-hmm. And like with the crop circles, if you can imagine a microwave beam that is able to exert a force on the object that it hits.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain way you can produce the microwaves by making them sort of sawtooth shape that actually exerts a force. And the evidence seems to point towards that this is what's going on with the crop circles, because they find evidence of microwave heating of the stalks.
Right. Blown nodes.
Right. And in fact, there's been some sightings where people see UFOs with beams coming down right during the time when those circles are being formed.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them might necessarily be due to ships. Some of it could be due to space platforms that we have. We probably have secret platforms there with microwave weapons on them.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be doing this as a way of testing them and confounding people at the same time.
Well, there's a lot confounding that's going on.
How this is connected to pulsars, so if you can imagine, if you had a technology that did that,
uh-huh.
you could have your transmitter, let's say, on a planet near a neutron star, transmitting a beam towards the surface of the star and creating a force field, sort of like a little shield disk, maybe let's say a few meters diameter,
mm-hmm.
And any cosmic rays from the neutron star that would be going through your shield would get decelerated and emit their energy as radio waves.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just turned that disk on and off, you could create like a periodic flashing. So this would be an easy way to produce the pulsar signals using technology that actually we have. We have this capability today to do this sort of microwave force field type of beam.
Well, let me ask you this, because there's a huge effort going on right now for the discovery of extrasolar planets. And in my mind's eye, I see this superwave bubble coming out from the center of the galaxy. And we have Stephen Hawking telling us, hey, folks, time to get off the mud ball. And we are looking for extrasolar planets. So like never before, there's since the late 90s when this really kicked into gear, we're probably approaching 300 extrasolar planets discovered. And the big emphasis right now is finding Earth-like extrasolar planets, just not brown dwarfs and gas giants and so forth. And we're sitting here looking at the sun with this fleet of solar observatories we're putting up between now and 2008. And we're looking for brown dwarfs in nearby regions, and there's a whole shift right now. I mean, I can remember for a long time the holy grail of astronomy was Big Bang Theory and when did it all begin, and now the Big Bang is becoming the Big Search to find out what's happening with our sun, to find planets elsewhere. So with all that in mind, do you feel that those who are in the know understand exactly what you're talking about? They've taken this message to heart, and they're already taking steps.
I don't know. I really don't.
Well, if they don't do it, and let's assume that there's a race out there that is going to take pity on us poor fools for squandering our chance to save ourselves and intervene and try and preserve us as a species in some way, I guess about the same way we do with salmon. And if they were to do that, how would that work? Assuming that they would want to intervene in a beneficent way.
Just speculating, they could probably pick us up in spacecraft and transport us in other ships. They'd go faster than the speed of light to other parts of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
This is all speculation. The other way would be maybe they would have tunnels underground here, with the idea of developing civilization underground. So whatever happens on the surface then doesn't matter. They develop some sort of underground agriculture and so on. to keep life going underground. But
and we become, what is it, like, you know, the Morlock?
Yeah. I don't know if it would be a very nice place to live. I suppose you could get used to it, huh?
Yeah.
They say humans can get used to anything once they forget.
Once they forget, yes, we do have that wonderful power of human denial going for us and against us as well. In the years looking ahead, let's say that the powers that be haven't figured this out yet. What should we be doing as a peoples, as nations, as individuals?
Well, first of all, I don't want to scare people into thinking we've got something that serious coming right now. The last one was barely able to affect the climatic pattern that happened 5,200 years ago. So maybe something small like that would happen for all we know. But it would definitely catch our attention. It could knock out satellites and communication systems. Could be more of a tragedy for modern technology than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But, what we can do to prepare we should be pushing our congressmen and our governments to develop alternative technology. You would want to have ability to generate your own power and not rely on a grid. The grids are going to go down if mm-hmm. such an event happens.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of thing.
Well, so basically, before we deal with the threat of the superwaves, we have to free ourselves of the enslavement of the energy companies.
Hmm.
I don't know, man. I think I'd much rather take my shot with a superwave. Those energy companies are pretty vicious. Anyway, for those of you out there, the link is on the every page on the site for decoding the message of the pulsars, and I definitely suggest that you get that and all the other books by Paul. And Paul, I want to thank you for coming back on Cut to the Chase. I look forward to the next time.
Okay, thank you, Marshall. Take care.
You too.
Take my hand, I will turn away. Life's too short to play these games. I want to love me just the way I am.
Well, that sure was another great interview with Paul. We've got two now, and I think you ought to go out and get this book. If you haven't gotten Earth Under Fire, you might want to snag that one, too. It was interesting that towards the end of the interview, we're talking about, well, what do we do about it? And I got to be honest, it came to me like Paul's really been working so hard on the theoretical aspects that he hasn't given that much thought to how us little people are going to get through it. Well, that's where I live in my thinking. And I'm no different than other Planet X 2012 researchers, folks looking at these catastrophic issues, like Egon Derive in Japan, or Jaco van der Warp in Holland, Andy Lloyd in England. And I have a little confession for you. We tend to be, as researchers, ahead of our audiences. And there's things we can talk about, and then there's things we know circumstances just haven't brought us to that point yet. And so people just tend to blow that off. Then a year later, maybe 2 years later, all of a sudden, we're on the money. It's no fun taking moon leaps when everybody else is taking baby steps. So when you see us going into areas that you think are frivolous or unnecessary, well, it's just because you haven't crossed that bridge yet. And that's really why Paul is equivocating at the end, saying after all of these catastrophic scenarios that, well, probably the worst that could happen is we lose a few satellites. That's a Pollyannish view. But on the other hand, that's what people want. And when you give them more than they want, they seldom appreciate it. And I'll leave it on that note. So until the next time we meet, remember Marshall's motto. Destiny comes to those who listen, and fate finds the rest. So learn what you can learn, do what you can do, and never give up hope. This is Marshall, and I'll catch you on the backside.